It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Northwoods summer camp is celebrating its 100th year in operation. We'll check out the camp's history, serving multiple generations of campers. First, health officials in Wisconsin are again sounding the alarm about synthetic cannabinoids, something sometimes called fake weed, K2, spice, and a host of other names. The Department of Health Services says that in the past 2 weeks, there have been 8 cases of severe bleeding and hospitalizations. That brings the total to 54 since March. So far, one person has died after using one of those products, a 33-year-old woman from Milwaukee. The bleeding is the result of one of the ingredients in some versions of the product, rat poison. So what exactly is this stuff and who's taking it? Dr. John Myman is the Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. Dr. Myman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, when people are looking at this stuff, these the so-called fake weed or synthetic cannabinoids, what is it? What's in it?
The challenge and the concern we have with these is that we really don't know what's in these. These have been around for a number of years. They're available all throughout the country. And when we're talking about these fake weed or synthetic cannabinoids or synthetic marijuana, goes under a number of names. And we're not really talking about one particular drug. We're talking about hundreds of different chemicals, all of which can have kind of different and unpredictable effects.
Can you talk about the legal status? I understand it's different here in Wisconsin than in many other states.
Sure. Yeah. You know, it is, you know, at the federal level, a lot of these chemicals are scheduled. They're not allowed. They're illegal. And then we have similar legislation here in the state of Wisconsin that does not make these drugs legal.
And what's strange is people might see these on the shelves at a truck stop or a paraphernalia shop, and they might think, well, somebody's selling it. It must be in some way legal and safe. And that is neither part of that is correct, right?
Correct. You know, I think that was kind of the perception at least a number of years ago when these were really very, very widely available and before they were restricted and made illegal. They were, you know, looked like they were marketed like any other thing you would see sold like at a head shop or a gas station. But no, they clearly are not safe, as we've seen with this recent outbreak.
Yeah. Can you talk about this recent outbreak? What are you at the health department seeing?
Yeah, so this one's a little different from some of the other ones we've seen over the last few years in other states. And some of these other outbreaks, you know, they've been linked to these drugs and the effects have been from those drugs specifically. Here in Wisconsin, what we're looking at is people who have used these drugs that have also contained an additional chemical in it, a rat poison, essentially, that's ended up causing severe bleeding. So really, they're consuming something that's containing two different chemicals in it, and one of those, the rat poison, is end up causing severe bleeding in some cases.
And how many cases are we seeing in Wisconsin of this severe bleeding from these products that include, as you say, rat poison?
Yeah, it's you know, we're tracking it day by day, but you know, right now we're about 40 confirmed cases. Those are ones that were people that we know were affected with these drugs that had this rat poison in it, and we're investigating 14 additional ones as well.
And worst case, we've had at least one fatality from this. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, we did have one fatality. There have been some other states where people have been taking similar drugs that also contain rat poison that have also had fatalities. So, yeah, we have had one. So if this, you know, if people don't seek prompt treatment, they can have severe life-threatening bleeding.
Are we seeing these products statewide, or are they limited, the ones with rat poison in particular, I should say, are we seeing these statewide, or are they in specific parts of the state?
You know, we've seen, you know, a handful of cases in a few different counties. The bulk of these cases, though, have been in Milwaukee.
We're talking to Dr. John Myman. He's with the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We're looking at so-called fake weed and the hazards for consumers. Now, at the Department of Health Services, what kind of efforts are you making to get the word out about these products?
Yeah, we're taking several different approaches. You know, early on, we wanted to get the word out to the healthcare community so they at least recognize these cases early on, because if people do get treatment, they can recover and avoid any of the serious life-threatening bleeding associated from using these drugs. And then the other part of our outreach has involved just getting the word out about these. So we've, you know, reached out through local health departments, put out a number of messages on social media, and then reached out to some of our you know, partners that work with substance using communities to try to get the word out to them as well.
As you say, products that call themselves fake weed or similar things have been around for a while. Why are we seeing this this rat poison tainted product now? And are they getting more popular?
I mean, that's a good question, and that's something that we hope to figure out by investigating this further. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not sure why this is happening, why they're putting this additional chemical in there, or even why it's in there to begin with. So it's one of the things we hope to learn.
Is part of the effort to reach out to retailers to say, hey, don't have this stuff on your shelves?
Well, that's, we focus more on getting out the information out to the healthcare community and out to people that may be using this. As far as, you know, outreach to retailers and that sort of messaging, that's generally handled by other agencies within the state government.
So for healthcare providers listening, what kind of things is the Department of Health Services telling them to watch out for?
Yeah, the main thing to look out for is one always, you know, ask when you see patients, you know, could you have been using these? If they have, you know, it's important to see if it could be experiencing any bleeding from it. There is a kind of inexpensive and easily available test to see if anybody has a clotting disorder that may make them more likely to bleed. That's easily done in most healthcare clinics. So it's really recognizing it early on, and because if people are recognized very early, they can get the antidote to the rat poison as soon as possible.
And if you had a message for consumers, people who might be thinking about using this product, thinking it's a safer alternative to some kind of illegal drug, what's the message to them?
Yeah, the message is we never can predict what is in these, and we cannot predict what the health consequences are. So the only safe thing to do is just to avoid them completely.
And before I let you go, what kind of efforts are there out there to monitor how many cases we're seeing, how bad they are, where they're happening?
So for this this current investigation, where we're looking specifically at people who have used it and ended up having bleeding problems, we've, you know, messaged widely to healthcare providers to let them know when they identify these cases. We're also working very, very closely with the Wisconsin Poison Center, which has been a really great partner. They've done a very good job handling some of the medical consultation, providing advice to medical providers on how to treat this, and working with the health department on identifying these cases and letting us know so we can do further investigation.
Is that poison center something that might be a resource for someone who might have taken one of these, realizes something bad is happening, they may have been poisoned by this thing they took?
Absolutely. The poison center is always a great resource, both for members of the public as well as healthcare providers. People are able to call there any time of day and get information. And if they have concerns, they can reach out to them.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Dr. John Myman is the Chief Medical Officer for the Wisconsin Department of Health Services. We talked with him about the rise in hospitalizations due to synthetic cannabinoids. Summer camp is a cherished memory for a lot of people around Wisconsin. A unique camp in northern Wisconsin has been creating those memories for one generation after another. And it's not just memories of crafts, camping, and canoeing. They're creating lessons about life and leadership. Camp Manitouish in Boulder Junction is celebrating its 100th year of camp. This past weekend, they held festivities to invite camp alums and the public to the camp's 307-acre location on Boulder Lake. Ann Derber has been the CEO of Camp Manitouish since 2000. Ann, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Well, 100 years for a summer camp. What is it that's led to the longevity of Camp Manitouish?
Well, you know, I think it's a couple of things. It is a program and an organization based on a mission that really hasn't changed in 100 years. The campers come and they have fun and they learn and they grow and they try new things. They take risks and they grow and gain that confidence, and they return, and then they bring the next generation back, and so forth. So we've been serving four generations, and I'm pretty sure the fifth generation was running around camp this weekend, so it was pretty awesome.
Yeah, talk about the festivities. It's a big deal, 100 years.
It is, and the Boulder Junction Chamber of Commerce and the community kick us off on Friday night at the community building with about 300 alums, and a big road band played, full of our alums as well, and it was just a great way to start and connect and a partnership with the Boulder Junction community. And then Saturday and Sunday we had canoeing and singing and different coaching periods and activities for kids and families to participate in. But I think the biggest thing was coming back and smelling the pines and eating in Nash Lodge and reconnecting with old friends that some hadn't seen for decades.
We hear stories about, you know, maybe kids these days not getting outside enough, worries about participation in things like 4-H and scouting. What is the value of summer camp and getting kids out there into nature?
You know, I think they get them out of their comfort zone. It's hard sometimes for parents to let their kids go, but boy, when they do, they really have a chance to figure out who they are. They have a chance to try new things and really explore and figure it out, problem solve, and have friends, and in a lot of cases have friends that last for a lifetime. And they get outside, and they're out of their comfort zone, and really provides a great opportunity for them to just be themselves.
And I understand this camp is gadget-free, no phones and tablets, right?
That is correct.
And what's the value of that?
Well, they have to talk to each other, and they have to problem solve without contacting Siri or Alexa. And they learn that they can sit around the dining room table with their cabin mates and eat lunch together and share the stories of the day. And that happens less and less, and it's so vital and so important to make that personal and human contact.
I want to dig into the history a little bit. This goes back to 1919. The camp was established for boys. Can you tell us a little bit about the foundation of Camp Manitouish?
Well, we actually, Walter Wones, who was a director at Phantom Lake in Muguanago, they wanted to find a location for boys that would provide a little bit more rugged experience and get them into the true wilderness of northern Wisconsin. And over time, we grew, and their sisters wanted to come to camp in 1941. And so we've been serving boys and girls separately, but the same program. And I think the opportunity to paddle and travel the waterways of northern Wisconsin was a drawing card and still a drawing card today.
Yeah, people think of canoeing and a lot of those traditional camp activities, but I understand Camp Manitouish really focuses also on leadership and other lessons like that.
You know, we've identified what we do as collaborative leadership. So we learn to build a shared vision. We learn that fellowship and leadership go hand in hand. We learn how to be resilient and resourcefulness and adapt to changing things that come before us. And that's the overarching work that we do, and the tools that we use are through summer camp and extended wilderness travel and leadership programs through schools and youth serving agencies and colleges and universities across the Midwest.
What are some activities that maybe have come and gone over time? Because that's a lot of history to draw from. Are they things that used to be part of the camp experience that have kind of faded away over time?
Well, I think, you know, all camps have traditions that come and go. We used to do early morning calisthenics every morning, and they used to bring the local barber in to cut the boys' hair when they were here to get them all cleaned up before they went home, and those are some of the things that we don't do today.
A part of the camp's history, I understand, is a cultural exchange that started after World War II.
That is correct. So our second director, Elmer Ott, was asked by the State Department to go over to Germany and help build German youth programs and bring them back to life and just help support the kids. And we made a connection point with a facilitator over there who became a close friend of Manitouish. And we began an exchange with Bad Münder, Germany, which is north of Hanover. And for a long time, adults and youth would go back and forth, and we still have German campers that come to our program today as an offshoot of that back in the late 60s.
Talking to Ann Derber, CEO of Camp Manitouish in northern Wisconsin. They just finished up their 100th summer as a camp here in Wisconsin, looking back at the past, present, and future of the camp. And the counselor of a camp is a time-honored tradition. And you hear at a lot of camps, you know, the campers grow up and then they become counselors. Is that something you've seen over the years there?
Absolutely. I'm a product of that myself.
Oh, really?
And so many of our alums that came to us as campers and wanted to come back and give back to the community, the camp community.
And as you're talking to people, especially over this celebration weekend, are you talking to parents and maybe grandparents who have sent that next generation to your camp?
Oh, absolutely. There were, as I said earlier, there were four generations, and there were 3- and 4-year-olds running around that I'm pretty sure are the fifth generation to come back to camp. So I feel like I was in the sweet spot. I was among the folks that raised me as a young camper and my peer group, and then those that were campers of mine and so forth. So it was pretty amazing and pretty incredible experience.
And I know the camp has a history of trying to bring in people who might not have the means to pay the traditional fare for summer camp. How do you reach out to different communities?
You know, word of mouth and support, and our alums are so, they really want our kids to have a camp experience regardless of their ability to pay. So we have a pretty incredible annual fund drive, and we allocate about $350,000 a year for campers to come to camp to make sure that they can come and have this experience, regardless of who they are, where they are, and their ability to pay.
I got to say, I, as a kid, didn't go to a summer camp. I didn't go to camps until a band camp, I guess, in high school. Can you sell the idea of summer camp, yours or another, to people who just, it isn't on their radar?
You know, I think it's really important to stop and think and realize that as a parent, we can't do it ourselves. And it really is a partnership with the families, and it's really an opportunity for to help the community, if you will, and in this case, a camp community, to help raise their children to be strong and confident and young adults. And I think it's so important in today's world to be grounded in oneself and to be able to contribute to others. And you could get that through a camp experience.
And a regret I had reading about Camp Manitouish is you're doing some pretty cool outdoor nature programs, again, more than just the standard canoeing. Can you explain to us some of the things that happen over the course of the summer?
So if you came to us as an entering fifth grader, you would come for 2 weeks, and then part of your two-week experience would be a 3-day canoe trip, 2 nights, 3 days, with a half-year cabin group, so 5 young men or young women and 2 staff members who would lead you on that experience. And as you grow and you want to explore more, we offer 9 to 45-day trips for young adults entering their freshman year of high school through senior year of high school. And we go to the Brooks Range in Alaska for 45 days, Inside Passage of Alaska for sea kayaking, and traveling and paddling Northwest Territories as the most extreme, if you will, adventure, an opportunity for growth, 9 to 45 days of sea kayaking, backpacking, and canoeing throughout North America.
And we've got a lot of different environments to grow up in Wisconsin. Do you see interesting combinations of kids coming from, you know, the big city to the farm and all points in between?
We do, and it's awesome to watch the wonder and awe with a night sky with no lights and the stars, and to hear the loons and to see an eagle fly over. It's pretty amazing to see on a regular basis, and certainly amazing for these young kids to see the same thing for the first time.
We've talked about some of the past and present of the camp. Can you bring us into the future a little bit? What are you looking at for the next, 100 years?
I think, and I hope that our program is continues to be rooted in our mission, and yet nimble and viable enough, if you will, to ensure that we can provide our experience regardless of the challenges that are thrown at us.
And I wanted to visit the weekend's events a little more. Can you share maybe some of the stories you heard from alums who came to celebrate with you?
Yeah, it was wonderful to watch the people walk down the pathway and see somebody they hadn't seen for 10, 15 years, and just the instant pleasure and smiles and hugs and tears and reconnecting. And while everybody's Manitouish experience is personal, we all share the same growth. We all share the same experiences of learning who we are and making those connections.
Now, I always wonder, summer obviously is your peak season. That's when most things happen. What is going on? What are you doing through the rest of the year to get ready for season 101?
We're recuperating after the weekend. No, we begin right away tomorrow morning. Our September, actually, we're a year-round institution. And so we will begin serving school groups tomorrow through our leadership program. We serve high school, middle school, colleges and universities, and youth serving agencies, and we've got school groups coming tomorrow. So cleanup is taking place today, and we will work with these groups throughout the year. Winter weekends include family groups coming up here and skiing on our cross-country ski trails and making community meals together and getting outside. And then we ramp up for school groups in the spring and then summer camp throughout the summer.
Now, you are a camper there, you said. You get to watch new groups of campers come in each and every year. Do you sometimes have that, I guess, moment of envy wishing you could start it all over again?
I sometimes look back and go, I'm getting old because my campers or their kids are coming back and their kids are on staff. So, of course. And I do, and but I still have the odd wonder of watching these young children grow up to be fabulous adults.
And that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Been talking to Ann Derber, CEO of Camp Manitouish. She joined us today to talk about the camp's 100th season they were celebrating over this Labor Day weekend. Want to hear from you, by the way. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Did you go to camp as a kid? What was your favorite? Or if you want to go there, least favorite memory of summer camp? Was it an important part of who you are, of your memories, of your life? Did you send your kids maybe to that same camp, whether it was Camp Manitouish or another park in Wisconsin or beyond? Send us an email, ideas@WPR.org, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Of course, if you're at the camp now, I guess you don't have that device handy. So maybe after you get home. Love to hear your camp experience. Membership in the middle class has historically been seen as a pretty comfortable life in the United States. People in the middle class could generally assume that they'd have a higher standard of living than their parents, that investing in a good education would pay off, and that being able to afford to have a family would be a given. But our next guest says that's changed, and many in the middle class are facing a more and more precarious financial reality. Alyssa Quart is executive editor and co-founder of the journalism nonprofit The Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She's the author of several books. Her latest is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Alyssa, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be on.
Well, you use the term middle precariat to describe the group of people that you're talking about, the people you talk to, feeling pressure from all sides, feeling squeezed. How does that phrase, middle precariat, sum up the people you're talking about here?
So this is what I saw in my reporting, and when I looked at the numbers, middle class used to mean stable, right? Almost humdrum. It was a regular job with regular hours and maybe a pension. You weren't reaching for the stars, but you were secure. Now it often means unstable jobs. You're squeezed both in terms of your money and your emotions. It's not being able to live with dignity and security.
And this really gets bad, you say. People really feel squeezed after the birth of a child, starting with the expenses of the birth of a child. Can you talk about how that's starting to affect people?
Yeah. So, I mean, I was just looking at the cost, literally, of labor around the world. And in the U.S., it could be $16,000 for a C-section, let's say. And then in other countries, it was something like $3,000. And just that. That alone was a real issue for many of the people I spoke to. If there was any complications, even when they had health insurance, they'd be in debt after giving birth.
And these costs for this middle class group often on top of a lot of student debt already.
Right. So, yeah, student debt is piling up. It's leading to people reconsidering having children at all. You know, there's that new study by the CDC, the data that women were having fewer children than at any point since 1978. That's 1.76 children over their lifetimes, down from 2.1 in 2007. And that's right, of course, right before the recession. That's a key number, right? So I think people are thinking, I have all this student debt. I have, you know, some of the people I spoke to had $140,000 in student debt. You know, how are they going to pay that back and have two children or even one child, and indeed pay for daycare and housing.
Right. You quoted one, I think one mom saying her long-term financial plan was to stop at one kid.
Yeah, exactly. Stop it. That was my family's plan as well.
And talk about how this weighs on people emotionally. And we'll talk a lot about the financial elements and the work and work-life balance elements here. But there's a lot of anxiety among the people in the middle class that you talk to.
Yeah, I think there's this worry about the future. You know, what's your life trajectory? So, yeah, I see squeezed as a financial phenomenon, but it's also a psychological and almost an existential one. Whereas, you know, these jobs, being a librarian or a teacher, professor, even a lawyer, used to have this regularity to it. Now it's sort of, what is going to happen? What, not only what's my old age going to look like, what's my middle age going to look like? Am I going to have, you know, money for vacations? Am I going to have money to pay for a mortgage? So it really changes the nature of how people see themselves. And that, of course, produces anxiety. It's also intergenerational. I think people, I've even at events I've done since the book has come out, people will stand up and they'll say things like, I was, you know, I tried to explain to my parents, you know, they're people in their 30s and 40s. They try to explain to their parents in their 70s what their life, what it takes to live a middle class life. And there's a real discrepancy intergenerationally.
Talking to Alyssa Quart, author of the new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And staying on the, I guess, the feelings side of this, Alyssa, a lot of feelings of guilt, that's an individual failing to not have the security, and blame, whether that's self-blame or blame of something else, someone else.
Yeah, so I think that was part of one of my readings of what happened in the election, even in 2016, because I feel like some of the people I spoke to were blaming themselves, but I know that many people who were struggling or on that sort of edgy middle-class identity blame others. They blame immigrants, they're Islamophobic, and one of the things I hope to do with this book and just these conversations we're having and conversations I hope people start having is looking for system fixes, looking for the system problems of why people are where they're at so they don't blame themselves and they don't blame other groups of people.
Right. That's if there's a running theme in your book or many running themes, that's one of them, the idea that from the perspective of one person or one family, this is an individual personal problem. But when it's happening again and again and again, you say this is some kind of structural problem. There's something bigger going on than one person's life decisions.
Yeah, and the people I spoke to, you know, some of them I call the hyper-educated poor. You know, they have graduate degrees. They felt like they did everything right. And so they even know they're not supposed to be blaming themselves, you know. But they're like, what's wrong with me? You know, they'll just say that after, you know, a couple conversations. They'd say, you know, why am I not able to make this work? And that was very striking to me. And sometimes I'd want to pipe in and say, and sometimes I did. I said, there's nothing wrong with you, or you've tried the best you could, you know. And the right response to where they're at is rage and reorganization and trying to rethink why we don't have things like paid family leave and all the rest.
Let's talk about that. There has been talk about trying to expand paid family leave in the United States. First of all, how does the U.S. compare to other developed, if we want to call them that, countries when it comes to family leave?
Oh, absolutely terribly. I mean, for one thing, you know, when I if we're just talking about things like daycare, you know, I went to Montreal and it was daycare cost $7 to $20 a day versus in the U.S. where it was, you know, there are people who I spoke to were spending 30% to even 38% of their incomes on daycare. And then in terms of maternity leave, you have 14% of the American workforce that gets paid family leave. Versus, you know, in multiple other countries, weeks and weeks of paid family leave and pregnancy leave as well.
Another issue when it comes to childcare is predictability. If you work a predictable 8 to 4, 9 to 6, whatever schedule, childcare is one thing. If you're working different times a day, working overnight, all of a sudden 24-hour random access childcare becomes an issue. What are people doing?
So yeah, so one chapter of my book, I look at what I call extreme daycare, and that's daycare that is happening in the evenings and on weekends and sometimes even overnight. And there was a study then that showed that today 9% of daycare services are being provided in these off hours, which would imply that people are working, you know, really strange clocks. I call them the forever clock. So it's like, you know, when do they stop working? When can they? How many jobs do people have to do to pay to have kids in this country? I embedded myself in one of these 24/7 daycares, and it was fascinating because, I mean, the kids were great. It was a sweet place. There was nothing wrong with it, but, you know, they were picked up sometimes at 10 o'clock at night, or, you know, they were dropped off early in the morning, or their parents would come at various strange times during the day. And the reason that was happening was because they were given only a certain amount of working hours that were completely not thinking about the workers as human beings and parents. So they'd be given teeny little slivers of work hours, and then they'd have to drop their kids at daycare to make sense of those hours they were being assigned.
And you say there's a fundamental issue of us devaluing the role of caregiving in the United States, whether that's the parent themselves or, say, somebody works at a child care and is paid not much in maybe a very expensive city to live in.
Yeah. So one thing I hope also to get across is that we do need to reframe care. You know, right now, with the paradox is that so many parents are spending so much of their money on daycare, but then the daycare workers themselves are really struggling. So I try to represent their experience as well. I didn't want it to just be one of those like privileged mom books or, you know, struggling privileged mom books. I wanted to show the workforce that's actually propping up some of those parents too and how much they're struggling. So there's a real disconnect. I mean, obviously what we need are more universal pre-K. We need more subsidized daycare for people who are not under the poverty line, you know, who are just holding on. So this is something I saw a lot of.
We're talking with Alyssa Court right now about her most recent book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. She's executive editor and co-founder of the journalism nonprofit, the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. And we want to hear from you. Do you feel squeezed? What are the main factors that make you have a hard time making ends meet, let alone getting ahead? Do you think things are different for you compared to your parents? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. We pick up our conversation now with Alyssa Court, executive editor and co-founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. We're talking about her latest book called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And we want to hear from you. Do the stories Alyssa has shared sound familiar from your experience or those of your friends? What are the biggest challenges for you to balance work, family, and the costs associated with trying to have both? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Alyssa, another issue I want to get into is the cost of housing. We hear again and again about, okay, the communities that have great jobs, maybe middle class pay type jobs, are in places where the middle class can't afford to live in them.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I talked to somebody who lived in the deep Midwest in an icy small town, and she was saying, "Oh, I'm not getting the work that, you know." She was a graphic artist. I'm not getting the work I need out here, you know. And that's one of the prices that people pay. So then they start moving it to cities. They move to near San Francisco or New York if they're in any of these kind of creative or so-called, you know, professions, media professions, right? And then they can't afford the housing that goes along with it. One chapter of my book is about school teachers outside San Francisco and places like San Jose who drive Uber. They drive Uber after work and on weekends, and they're doing that because they're having trouble paying for their apartments. One-bedroom apartment in San Francisco averaged $3,500 a month. So that was, you know, he was driving his Uber instead of preparing his curriculum.
Let's go to our callers now. Carol is with us in Wausau. Carol, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Carol?
I just wanted to make the comment that as a parent and grandparent and someone who has worked all my adult life, that in having children and looking for daycare, that it certainly has been an issue both in availability as well as cost. However, I do want to comment that being a parent is a choice. And when you have children, one of your considerations should be, can I afford the cost of raising that child, including daycare and housing and all the other things that go with it? So again, I am sympathetic to the issue, but I also would like to point out that parenting, being a parent and choosing to be a parent, has its responsibilities and the costs that come with it.
Carol, thanks a lot for that call. And Alyssa, that cost is changing, you write, and you write that a lot of people are making that decision now to maybe not have kids solely or mainly because of those cost issues.
Yeah, I mean, I do understand what the caller's saying, and I challenge some of the things that some of the people in my book, including myself, were told. We were told, do what you love and follow your dreams as a worker. And these are things we need to start rethinking, and we need to start rethinking whether we go to graduate school, whether we do all these things and, you know, mount this debt before we have children. By the same token, I don't know how many of the people who, in fact, did do everything right, as it were, how they could do differently. I mean, they're spending every last dime on daycare and after school care in order to work, in order to support the family. So it's a vicious cycle.
Carol, thanks for that call. I'll go next to Margaret in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What do you think, Margaret? What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a 4-year-old and I have an 8-month-old, and I can really relate to what you're talking about. Our situation that we've experienced recently with my second daughter, I was on bed rest for 14 weeks, and that was totally unexpected. You know, we knew that kids were expensive, but, like, it was expensive in a different way because my husband had to quit his job to take care of us and hasn't really gotten back into the workforce since, even though he's been trying to. So, it's a really, really difficult time, and we're feeling that squeeze. We have lots of ways that we try to make money go farther, but it's been a real, real challenge, not just having little kids, but having little kids and having no money.
Margaret, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Alyssa, one of the first people you talk about in the book, they're in a situation, I think, where they say, you know, if everything goes just right and nothing goes wrong, we can get by, but there's always something that could go wrong.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just thinking about the one small medical thing that goes wrong, and then your husband or your wife is forced to be a child, you know, both a child care and a spouse care provider. And that's where pregnancy leave or maternity leave is even more necessary, right? Because those things do come up. I mean, I was just going to say, for new parents in England, you get 280 days of, you know, parental leave at 90% pay. And Canada, 119 days at 55% pay. So, you know, I also had, you know, hyperemesis, which when I was pregnant, I was not in great shape after my daughter was born because I'd been sick for all those months, just like you. And so those days of leave would sure have been come in handy.
Thanks for the call, Margaret, and good luck. We're talking to Alyssa Court, author of the new book, Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Back to your calls, Lee in Glidden. Lee, hi.
Hi. Mine's kind of a different thought on this. I consider myself a part of the middle class, lucky that I don't feel squeezed. But my observation has been that the problem goes deeper than this, and I think it goes down to Americans don't care about other Americans anymore. You know, why don't we have maternity leave and daycare and health insurance for everyone? It's because I don't want to pay more taxes because I got to have more for me. So in Europe, they're not doing that. They care more about the society.
Thanks for the call. Alyssa, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think there's a sense that we're supposed to take care of ourselves. It's a sort of ruthless individualism. And it's not just, you know, bootstrapping. It's also, you know, as women workers, we're told to lean in, right? And to take what's ours. And that's also individualistic. It's not thinking, how do we get together as a class, really, especially women as a class, and start to, you know, connect and talk openly about our situation and try to change things.
Lee, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Delia in Three Lakes. Delia, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a comment regarding a short maternity leave. It's only, unfortunately for my employer, it's only 3 months, so 6 weeks paid and 6 weeks is unpaid. And I'm originally from Russia. I know they give them about maternity leave. I chose to breastfeed my baby, and it was very hard because I worked as a critical care transport nurse, so couldn't really pump much when you're in the back of the ambulance with a patient. So very challenging to provide the best care for your child and try to maintain that salary.
Delia, thanks so much for sharing that. She mentioned breast bumping, and that's been an issue. You talk about women airline pilots trying to deal with this issue, Alyssa.
Yeah, I talked to a couple of people who worked in jobs where they were sort of there was no clean spaces for them to pump. They said, oh, you can do it in the bathroom, or were they sometimes set aside strange rooms off to the side in, say, in an airport, which didn't really answer the question. So that's a very parallel to your experience. And I mean, basically, there's not very much protection for these experiences. So they say, okay, go back to work. You know, you can pump in this, you know, in the bathroom, and that's just not really good enough. We need more pumping stations everywhere.
Thanks for that call. One issue we haven't gotten into that I wanted to touch on, Alyssa, is the risk of automation, and if this affects people working and middle class and a lot of jobs that people might not have thought could be automated. So again, as you say, if people do things right, their job might not exist anymore after a while.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's also going to affect women predominantly. There's a new study that showed that, you know, 57% of the jobs that are going to be lost are going to be female workers. And one thing that interested me was these were often middle-class professions that were threatened by the robots. It wasn't just, you know, retail work, which is already, like, if you go to a supermarket, right, you may be checking it out with an automated checker. It was things like there's pharmacists, there's robot pharmacists, there's robots doing the work of lawyers, and yes, doing the work of journalists. They have there's a program called Automated Insights, which to me is an oxymoron, but and it's doing it's providing so-called, you know, content for news services like Forbes.
Very briefly, Alyssa, are people talking about these things beyond your book and the response to it?
I feel like people are starting to. I've been really happy to see articles. Like, there was a recent article in the New York Times about wages not keeping up. You know, like, oh, this is a moment of prosperity, but it's mostly corporate wealth. It's not wages, and prices are still really high. I just want people to refocus on what life is actually like on the ground for many people. And I don't know, I've been feeling optimistic. Also, there's a lot of new talk about universal basic income, which would be a certain amount that might be given to members of the population that's being piloted in Stockton, California, and also in Ontario, in Canada. And I feel like that is now getting traction.
Thanks to Alyssa Court, executive editor and co-founder of the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. She's the author of several books. Join us today to talk about her latest. It's called Squeezed: Why Our Families Can't Afford America. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out day one of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh's Senate confirmation hearings. Find out how President Trump could affect November's elections here in Wisconsin and around the country. And a guest shares a photo project tracking roadside memorials around the state. That and look at some of the top news of the day coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. You may have noticed I was off the show for a couple weeks. I was actually out of town for a couple weeks, and I came back to my garden. Garden's a strong word. There's not a lot going on there. Most of the things have failed, I think, because of too much rain. But then there's the zucchini. I came back. I'd invited my neighbors to come and you know, take all they wanted. They did not. So I had a medium-sized zucchini, a bunch of little ones, and then six, you know, tactical zucchini, big baseball bat-sized guys. So I've been going nuts over the weekend. I stir-fried the smaller one, and then I got serious yesterday. Ground up three of them, a big pot of zucchini soup, four loaves of zucchini bread. So I had six of these big ones, four loaves of zucchini bread, and then a chocolate zucchini cake that I brought into work. And everybody here on Labor Day has been eating it and taking seconds to finish it off. After all of that, I still have three monster-sized zucchini left. I've already made zucchini relish before we left. I froze a bunch before we left. I still have all these. I think somebody on the show a few weeks ago had said, I don't remember if it was a caller or a guest, in their community, if you leave a zucchini in an unlocked car, you got to be careful because somebody's going to break in and leave more zucchini for you. So I'm interested in hearing from you. Let me know how you are using that zucchini surplus if you have one. Share your favorite recipe, maybe even pictures if you have them. You can email, love to see them, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or have you just been giving them away or politely leaving them on your neighbor's doorsteps for them to deal with? Share your zucchini solutions, ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time.